Hello, everyone, and welcome to The Green Score, the podcast that looks at what changes we can make in our everyday life to really make a difference in the fight against climate change. So today we are looking at toilet paper. So not the most glamorous of topics, but perhaps one of the most widely used products we've covered, I think. I was looking at some stats in preparation for the podcast, and there were just crazy numbers. In the UK, it's estimated each person will use nearly 600 miles of the stuff in their lifetime. In the States, it's nearly 650 miles, while China alone uses 4 billion miles worth of toilet roll in a single year. And to put that in perspective, if you went 4 billion miles, that would take you close to Pluto on the very edge of our solar system. So crazy numbers. But have you ever wondered what those sheets on your cheeks are doing for the planet? Over 31 million trees cut down per year to serve the US alone. It's something like 6 million in the UK. So huge amounts of trees being cut down. What's the impact of that on our environment? And is there a better option? How do we keep our bum and the planet happy?
It's definitely a question I've wondered about, Jake, which is why I'm super excited for our speaker today. We have Michael Zelnicker, who is a Canadian actor and filmmaker who recently directed the documentary The Issue with Tissue, A Boreal Love Story. And this documentary discusses the boreal forest that is home to Indigenous First Nation communities and how it is being clear cut for manufacturing of toilet paper. Michael, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. Nice to be with you.
So, Michael, to start us off, could you just tell us a bit about yourself, what you do, and how you got interested in sustainability?
Well, I grew up in Montreal, in Canada. I spent most of my life working in the entertainment industry, most of that time working as an actor. Very lucky. I got to travel all over the world, work with amazing people, directors, other actors, craftspeople. I won some awards for my work. After a number of years working across Canada in theaters and on film stages, I won a Canadian Academy Award, a Genie Award, for a movie called The Terry Fox Story. This allowed me to get my papers to begin working in the U.S. My first audition was for a movie called Touch and Go, in which I had to play hockey. Lucky for me, growing up in Montreal, the 11th commandment is thou shalt play hockey. So after auditioning for the director, they sent me out to the hockey arena, and I played hockey better than the hockey coordinator on the film. So I got the job. It was shooting here in Los Angeles. I fell in love with the place. We have the ocean on one side, the mountains on the other. And so I moved here soon after. And as I said, I got to travel all over the world working on some amazing projects. In 2004, I was invited to begin teaching at film school here in Los Angeles. I actually love teaching. In some ways, my life's purpose was to try and understand this ephemeral, mysterious thing called creativity. And when you have to give it away to young people who are beginning their creative journeys, you learn a lot about your work yourself. So teaching was a wonderful opportunity for me that I did for 14 years. In 2018, I sort of felt like I had done what I could in that area. I'm also a lifelong environmentalist. When I was 8 years old, I used to walk around the streets of this shopping area in Montreal, admonishing people to stop littering. These were my first acts of civil disobedience. In 2018, the Climate Reality Project, former Vice President Al Gore's organization, probably your listeners know that in 2006, when An Inconvenient Truth was released, Mr. Gore looked around and realized that his singular voice traveling around the world, delivering these personally curated slide decks, these PowerPoint presentations, that his voice alone was not going to really move the needle. And so he began training people with 50 people in his barn in Tennessee. He's now trained about 40,000 people around the world. So in 2018, there was a training happening here in Los Angeles. I submitted an application. I was accepted and I went through the training. 3,000 people in the Los Angeles Convention Center was among the most inspiring experiences of my life. After the training, I then raised my hand and volunteered to see if I could serve in some way the Los Angeles chapter of the Climate Reality Project. And I was elected to be the co-chair of the chapter. And I spent 2.5 years doing that as a volunteer. We activated around a wide variety of issues. Perhaps the one that is most noteworthy, we lobbied the Los Angeles Unified School District, which is the second largest school district in the country, 700,000 students, 30,000 teachers, 28,000 support staff, 1,100 schools. It's the size of a city on its own, the largest emitter of greenhouse gases in Los Angeles County. We persuaded them to make a commitment to transition to clean renewable energy on a timeline that's more ambitious than the city, county, or state. So I guess my roots in environmental activism go back a long way. I can't really say why. I know that when I was 8 years old and I was shipped off to summer camp, I was a troubled young man. And so I was always in trouble. And the one thing that soothed me, that saved me, was this endless vista of trees and forests as far as the eye could see, right out to the edges of the horizon. And then this forged in me a love of forests and trees, so much so that when I'm in a forest, I feel like I'm with long lost family.
I love how you say that coming to a forest is like being with long lost family. I totally get a similar experience, except with mountains. Like, I grew up surrounded by mountains. I'm from Southern California, so very close to LA. And I just know every time I get on top of a mountain, it's just like you can breathe a bit differently than when you're in your home or in the city or whatever. So I totally relate to that. But let's dive into toilet paper. Jake gave us a couple kind of stats to set the tone, but could you tell us a little bit more about kind of why you got interested in toilet paper and how much toilet paper a typical person uses?
Well, in April 2020, about a month into the pandemic, around the time we were all hoarding toilet paper of all things, you know, I received an email from NRDC, the Natural Resources Defense Council, that these large intact old growth forest landscapes across the Canadian boreal are being clear cut for toilet paper. And I thought to myself, is there a more obscene illustration for what's gone wrong? So I began to reach out to people, and one conversation led to another. And before I knew it, 3.5 months later, I was on a plane to Vancouver, quarantined for 14 days before embarking on a 42-day journey from one end of the boreal to the other. The boreal forest, incidentally, is the largest intact remaining forest landscape across the planet. It's kind of a green halo that circles northern Canada into Alaska, across Siberia, northern Russia, into Scandinavia, and back into Canada. It dips down into a little bit of southern Greenland, but it is like a green halo right around, circling the northern hemisphere. And it's an ecosystem that most people know almost nothing about. Most people, when I told them, you know, I'm doing this documentary about the boreal forest, they would go, Aurora Borealis? So our reference to the boreal forest is kind of obscure. And, you know, when most people think about and talk about forests, they think about tropical rainforests, the Amazon, or even our temperate rainforests that are also very important. But the boreal forest stores more carbon than any other terrestrial landscape by far in the world. And given that this ecosystem is almost completely unknown, in some ways, as I reached out to various people and began to learn more about it, it's the nesting ground to 2 billion birds. Approximately 2 billion birds nest there every year. All the birds that we love and appreciate in our backyards and in our parks, you know, here in the United States and all the way down into South America, those birds are migrating south from the boreal forest. It is home to more than 600 First Nations communities, a place they've called home for many thousands of years. So toilet paper, you know, Jake gave a lot of the really relevant statistics. Toilet paper is made from tree fiber. Many people don't even know that. I don't know if you guys saw a documentary some years ago called Food Inc. What was so amazing about that documentary is how it draws a connection between that fast food hamburger on our plate and the industrial farming that it comes from, and the kinds of impacts, environmental impacts, climate change impacts that industrial farming is having. But these are also places where animals are tortured, literally tortured. And so when people made a connection between that hamburger on their plate and where it was coming from, these industrial farms, it changed a lot of people's perspective on their diet and how they were eating and what they were eating. So I felt like if we could draw a connection between these existentially critical forests and the toilet paper we use to wipe our bums, that perhaps it might forge people, might inspire people to review and change what we're using, you know, in our bathrooms.
You know, I feel because toilet paper is so widespread. I was looking at I've switched to bamboo toilet paper recently because I'd started to really think about what I was using on my bum, basically. And because it's such a big part of your life, toilet paper, you don't engage with thinking about the reality of how that got to your bathroom, right? So I think that what you said about making the connection, you're so right. I hadn't really myself thought about it until recently, but when you start to think about the scale, how much toilet paper you use on a daily basis. But where's that actually coming from? Probably like many people, I haven't really engaged with that.
And, you know, logging companies, when they look at a forest landscape, they value it just in terms of dollars and cents, not in terms of the kinds of feelings and experiences that a forest landscape engenders in us. But perhaps most importantly, the very oxygen that we breathe, that we rely on, comes from those forests and trees. As I say in the movie at one point in a narration, forests and trees perform a kind of CPR on us every breath of every day. And so we don't make the connection that our very survival depends on these forests and trees. So when we cut them down for things like toilet paper, of all things, I mean, I'm not someone who believes that we have to stop using our forests and trees for wood. We need wood. Wood is a much more sustainable, much more eco-friendly product to build houses and buildings with than cement, concrete, steel. So, you know, we have approximately 1 billion people around the planet that don't have reliable shelter. So we are going to have to use our trees and forests to build, but we shouldn't be using them for toilet paper. And just to speak a little bit about it, toilet paper is made from virgin wood fiber or from a combination of recycled paper pulp mixed in water with chemical sulfates to help it break down, starches that create wet strength and chemicals, bleaches to make it white. Virgin fiber toilet paper is, and that's what most toilet paper is made from. Virgin fiber toilet paper is made with a combination of approximately 70% hardwood and 30% softwood. Trees are debarked and chipped into small pieces. Remember, these are living creatures that we exchange with, right? We take the oxygen that they emit, that they exhale. They take our CO2 that we exhale. They convert that CO2 into oxygen, this magical, wonderful process called photosynthesis. And that oxygen that they then breathe out is what we breathe in. So trees are debarked and chipped into small pieces. The wood chips are mixed with water and chemicals to make what's called slurry. The slurry is sent to a pressure cooker called a digester. The slurry is cooked, evaporating the moisture, leaving a batch of virgin cellulose fibers called pulp. The pulp is washed to remove the lignin, which is the yellow adhesive that binds fibers together in cooking chemicals. The virgin fiber pulp goes through a bleaching process to remove color from the fiber. The pulp is mixed with water to produce paper stock containing 99.5% water and 5.5% fiber. The paper stock is sprayed, moving mesh screens, which allow much of the water to drain. A wide sheet of matted fiber is sent through a large heated cylinder called a Yankee dryer. Don't know why, called a Yankee dryer. The toilet paper is pressed and dried to a final moisture content of about 5%. The paper is crepped to make it soft and wrinkled. During crepping, the paper is scraped off the Yankee dryer with a metal blade to make large, wide sheets. The sheets are wound into large rolls and sent to converting machines. The toilet paper is unwound, slit, and rewound into long, thin cardboard tubing, making a paper log. The paper logs are then cut into rolls and wrapped in packages. And that's the process that our beautiful, life-giving, life-sustaining trees go through in order that we can wipe our bums with softer, more plush toilet paper.
You know, when you put it like that, it's quite violent, isn't it? The whole process. Okay. What is the environmental impact of all of that, of chopping down all of those trees? Of, you're talking about chemicals there, like the process. I mean, I think we'll come on to the kind of the community impact later, but just on the environment, what's the impact of that?
So logging in the boreal forest releases an estimated 26.5 million metric tons of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. I'll say that again, 24.4 million metric tons of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. That's roughly a quarter of all the carbon emitted from all the trucks and cars in the U.S. Among the ways that toilet paper adds carbon into the atmosphere, well, logging disrupts carbon within the soil because carbon in the boreal, 80% of the carbon, unlike in tropical rainforest, so in tropical rainforest, most of the carbon is stored in the wood, in the trunks, the branches. Because of the climate, the weather in the boreal, which is very cold, trees grow more slowly. they have a much, much shorter growing season. 80% of the carbon is actually stored in the soil. So when we disrupt that soil, all of that carbon is released into the atmosphere. There is so much carbon stored in the boreal that it is estimated that the amount of carbon stored in the boreal is equivalent to twice the amount of carbon stored in all the remaining oil reserves on the planet.
That's insane. That's wow. Way more than I would have thought.
We're told that our carbon bank account will allow us to burn about 30% of the remaining fossil fuels on the planet to remain within that 1.5 degrees Celsius range that we're told by climate scientists is a habitable range, a range that we can sustain the consequences, the impacts. So if the boreal stores approximately twice as much as all the remaining oil reserves on the planet, and we're told we can only burn approximately 30% of those oil reserves to remain within that 1.5 degree range, if we were to allow all of the carbon that's stored in the boreal to be released into the atmosphere, it doesn't matter what else we do, it's game over. And so as we log in this carbon-rich ecosystem, we are literally, well, as one of the elders says in the movie, what we do to the land, we do to ourselves. As we go into these wild spaces and we destroy these wild spaces that we literally depend on for our very survival, we are destroying ourselves.
Is any part of this ecosystem protected?
Some small pieces are protected, but very, very small percentages of it. A good portion of it is in the northern part of the boreal, and that's where a lot of the carbon is stored in the soil in what are called peatlands, these wet, sort of boggy areas all around the Hudson Bay, lowlands, James Bay. That area stores larger numbers of carbon that we can't even fathom, that I certainly can't quantify. And those wetlands, those peatlands, store so much carbon in the soil. So those areas are protected from logging, but they're not protected from mining. And right now, there's an area in northern Ontario called the Ring of Fire, where the Ontario government is insisting development must take place. So we have a very strange situation in Canada where jurisdiction is divided between the federal government and the provincial government. The federal government has authority over things like the Endangered Species Act, a lot of environmental regulation, but provinces in Canada have purview, have regulatory authority over resource development. So anytime the federal government tries to intervene and tell a province that this kind of industrial development is deleterious to our environment, to the rest of creation, to human beings, to, you know, the environment in general, the provincial government will take the federal government to court and claim that that's outside the federal government's jurisdiction. So to give an example, in 2012, so the indicator species in the boreal is woodland caribou. This is a beautiful species, you know, what we call reindeer. Woodland caribou are in distress, are endangered, or certainly in some level of distress in virtually every herd across Canada. So the federal government in 2012 mandated that every province had to come up with a habitat restoration plan so that woodland caribou, their numbers could begin to regenerate. It's now 2023. Not one province has come up with a habitat restoration plan. And we finally have a Minister of Environment, Stephen Guilbeault, who is threatening to take provinces to court if they don't come up with a habitat restoration plan. So something I didn't understand clearly, indicator species means the species that indicates the health and well-being of the ecosystem in which it inhabits. So if woodland caribou are endangered or in some level of distress in virtually every herd across Canada, then they are indicating, they are shouting that this ecosystem is in distress. And to give one example, the George River herd in the early 1990s had approximately 800,000 individuals in its herd. Today, that number is about 8,100.
So you've got this amazing ecosystem that's A, being destroyed by mining, and B, is being used to produce toilet paper. And I'm sure we're going to come on to the fact it doesn't have to be that way, right?
It really doesn't. So for many, many years now, I used recycled post-consumer toilet paper. It has one third the carbon footprint that tree fiber toilet paper has. You talked about bamboo toilet paper. Well, you know, bamboo grows much more quickly. It's a much more sustainable commodity than tree fiber is. It absorbs a much higher level of carbon. So as it grows, it's absorbing a lot of carbon in its process of photosynthesis. Bamboo crops can thrive in a variety of climates. They occupy less space than boreal forests. They don't need to be replanted once harvested and don't require the use of fertilizers or pesticides. Bamboo products produce 30% fewer emissions than those made of virgin tree fiber. And for those of us who want to go wet and wild, there's the bidet. I use a little handheld bidet myself that attaches very easily to your toilet tank, and it's actually a cleaner way of cleaning yourself than using toilet paper. And for those who really want a souped up version of bidet, you can get really expensive, like $600 ones that whoosh around your bum with some nice warm water. And I've not had that experience, but I can tell you I have converted to the wet and wild, and it's a wonderful experience. And it has a much lighter carbon footprint.
I have to say, so my husband is Italian and he is so pro bidet. He's like, we need to get one. He just recently moved to the US and he's like, they're nowhere here. This is terrible. So he would totally agree with that suggestion.
And South Park did this really, really wonderful episode on bidets. And they intercut actual footage in this animated series. They intercut actual clear-cut logging footage into the episode to show that these boreal forests are being cut down needlessly for the manufacture of toilet paper. It's a really fun episode that was just out a couple of months ago.
Jake, are you going to go and watch that South Park episode now?
I am, yeah. I used to watch South Park when I was a kid because it was cool when you were 10 to watch it with your friends. But obviously, it all went straight over my head. And I started rewatching it recently. Now I'm an adult and I can understand it. And it's now one of my favorite shows again. So good. So yes, I will check that one out.
You're going to have to fast forward to the toilet paper one. So we're saying there's recycled paper options, and that's something like a third of the carbon footprint of virgin paper. It's also the bamboo options, which Jake has switched over to, and that's something like 30% lower greenhouse gas emissions than normal paper. There's the bidet option. I have actually seen reusable, like washable cloth toilet paper as well. There was some little stand at the farmer's market the other day that was selling these reusable toilet paper options. So there are some alternatives out there. They do have lower environmental impact, which is great. One thing I'm curious about, is there something people should look out for in terms of like certain certifications or companies when they're trying to purchase these more sustainable toilet paper options?
Well, you know, certainly not to appear like this is an advertisement for anybody. Just to give a little bit of guidance to your listeners, in the US, there is a company called Who Gives a Crap. And it's for those of us who actually give a crap, because they make their toilet paper products, their tissue products, because they both facial tissue, toilet paper, and paper towels. Paper towels is another enormous source of tree fiber paper products like Bounty and Charmin, for instance. You know, Procter & Gamble is the largest sourcer of boreal tree fiber. But Who Gives a Crap makes their paper products from 100% post-consumer recycled paper. So that's important too, recycled, that's made from post-consumer, that is branded post-consumer. And then on the bamboo side, there's a company called Plant Paper, and they source their bamboo from organic bamboo. They use no dyes, no bleaches. And like Who Gives a Crap, their products are not wrapped in plastic. So all of their wrapping paper, even that the toilet paper or tissue paper or a paper towel comes in, is also from either post-consumer recycled paper or from bamboo. So these are much more sustainable ways. So there is a certification system around the world called FSC, Forest Stewardship Council. There are other certification systems that are really just fronts for the logging industry. So the only one that the experts that I spoke to endorsed is the FSC system, the Forest Stewardship Council system. And you can find that logo, FSC, on any wood product or paper product that has that certification. But as a certification system, it is the only certification system that you will hear environmental NGOs and conservationists speak of in a supportive way.
Okay, so look for that FSC certification. And maybe this is a nice segue to some of the bigger themes of your documentary, because I know it dives into some deeper issues around, you know, colonial violence, industrial exploitation, and the indigenous First Nations that call the boreal forest home. Could you tell us a bit more about that?
So perhaps the most important insight I had, and I'm actually a little bit reluctant to call it an insight, but maybe the most important observation I had was early on, I learned that the boreal is home to more than 600 First Nations communities, a place they've called home for many thousands of years. So it was clear to me very early on that any story about the boreal forest had to place the indigenous peoples who call it home at the front of the telling of that story. And I was very, very lucky because I reached out to some indigenous leaders I was introduced to. One conversation led to another, and they all welcomed me with a quality of hospitality that I've never experienced before in my life. And to this day, I'm often asked at screenings by people why the indigenous people who we interviewed for our documentary speak with such stunning candor, such vulnerability and honesty. And I think it's because they sensed my sincerity and they knew that I had not come with an agenda. I came with a camera willing to listen to what they needed to talk about with respect to what they needed to talk about. And that turned out to be colonization. The impacts of colonization and the Indian Act, residential schools, the 60 scoop, the atrocities that Indigenous people in Canada have undergone since the beginning of Confederation in Canada. Growing up, the history I was taught in Canada was that Sir John A. Macdonald, our first prime minister, and then a prime minister in the 1870s as well, we had Confederation in 1867, when Canada became an independent country from the United Kingdom. We were taught that John A. Macdonald was our father of Confederation, and he was portrayed in heroic terms. But John A. Macdonald was the architect of the Indian Act, which was really just a plan to commit a genocide against the original people of Canada. It denied them language. It denied them culture, who they were. The Indian Act was designed to strip the Indian from the child. That is the actual term from the Indian Act, to strip the Indian from the child. And this resulted in the development of what became known as residential schools, where children were kidnapped from their homes. Parents were told that if the child was not permitted to attend residential school for the 9 or 10 months of the year that residential schools ran, that the parents would be put in jail. So parents were left with no choice but to give their children over to the Canadian state. And the worst atrocities were committed in these residential schools. We are now beginning to go through a process called Truth and Reconciliation in Canada. What I heard often from Indigenous peoples was truth before reconciliation. But my experience was the experience of a lifetime. As I said, I was welcomed with a quality of hospitality that I've never experienced before in my life. They spoke about nature and conservation and sustainability in a way that I had never heard before. They recognized the rest of creation as just another member of the family, that we are all one big family. As Elder A.J. Felix of Sturgeon Lake First Nation says towards the end of the movie, as we turn to the way forward, what I call the way forward, he talks about this, I'll quote him. He says, "Let's be family again. Let's be relations again. Let's love each other, because when we love, we respect and we look after each other." And this concept was easily married for me to a concept that I heard from Dr. Suzanne Simard, a forester, a researcher, a scientist who has spent 40 years trying to prove that forests exist, they strive and thrive through these underground subterranean networks called mycorrhizal networks, these hyphal networks that link trees to mosses to fungi, where they exchange resources amongst each other in mutually beneficial, collaborative, cooperative relationship. So unlike this Darwinian theory of evolution where, you know, we must adhere to this understanding that competition is to the death and survival of the fittest, that in fact, forests and trees survive and thrive through cooperative, collaborative relationships. And trees have been on the planet for almost 400 million years, a lot longer than we have been, many, many, many millions of years longer than we humans have been. So when Elder Dave Porter says, when we're in a forest, we're with our ancestors. The trees are our elder ancestors. They're talking to us, telling us stories of life. The question is, are we listening? So this combination of scientific, mycorrhizal, mutually beneficial, collaborative, cooperative relationship, combined with this idea that we are all family with these trees and forests, that the trees and forests are our ancestors, and they have been here a lot longer than we have. Surely they have something to teach us about longevity and sustainability. And I've come to believe that what they're trying to teach us is the way forward lies not in this survival of the fittest and competition to the death, but through an understanding that we are all in this enterprise called life together. And when we respect each other and understand this connection that we have to each other, because I've come to believe that the largest systemic issue that we're going to have to confront and reconcile is the one of disconnection, disconnection from each other, disconnection from the land, disconnection from the rest of creation. This disease of disconnection is what allows us to do things like colonization, treat our brothers and sisters in such an inhumane way. It's what allows us to throw away the future of our children. It's what allows us to treat the rest of creation in the kinds of ways we do, as a commodity that is meant to be used for our own benefit. So those are the larger themes that we embrace in our movie, and they are mostly voiced. They are mostly articulated by the Indigenous elders and leaders that opened their hearts and shared their stories with us.
I think I watched the trailer, and obviously I was talking to Michael before this, how kind of moving I found it, particularly the difference between the beauty of the landscape versus the trauma of their stories. When you compare the two, as you do in the trailer and the movie, it makes it even more shocking. Can you tell me what nature means to them culturally? Because I got the impression that it's alive for them, right? Can you talk a bit more about that, and therefore the impact that has on them when they see it getting destroyed or cut down?
Well, I think you said it exactly right. They see the rest of creation as a member of the family, because they have identified their own survival as dependent on these other members, these other aspects of creation. That, again, as I said earlier, we literally depend on our breath of life from the trees and plants that populate the planet. We depend on those trees and plants to feed us. We depend on the animals for those who choose to eat. We depend on those animals to feed us. The Innu and other communities, other tribes, other nations in Canada call themselves a caribou people. So when we destroy woodland caribou, when we destroy their habitat so we can wipe our bums with softer, more plush toilet paper, we're destroying habitat for the caribou. The Innu call themselves a caribou people because for thousands of years, their very survival has depended on the caribou. Their food, their clothing, their medicine, their tools. Every part of the caribou was used for some aspect of life. So when we destroy habitat for the caribou, we are destroying the way of life for these people, the Innu. So there is a connection. We see this through the first segments of my movie where we sort of connect clear-cut logging to the destruction of habitat. You destroy habitat, you destroy the place that woodland caribou depend on for living. When you destroy caribou, you destroy way of life for the Innu. Well, what is the ultimate destruction of way of life? Colonization. They're all connected. But Indigenous people don't see a separation, a division. When I go walking in a forest, I feel connected, but I don't have that same sense of connection because growing up, when I wanted something to eat, I went to the refrigerator or went to the supermarket with my mother. When Indigenous people for thousands of years look for breath, food, shelter, medicine, they looked in nature and they found it there. And so sustaining and conserving nature means sustaining and conserving their own life. It goes back to that subtitle line of our film. What we do to the land, we do to ourselves. If we take care of the land will take care of us. If we destroy the land, we destroy ourselves.
Do you know what, Michael? I don't know what I expected from toilet paper. It seems a very dry subject, right? Seems very black and white. I'll be honest, I'd never thought about where it comes from. If I did think about where it came from, I assume that it came from, I don't know, vast pine forests in Finland where there's just millions of it and it doesn't have any impact. I think this has been really, really eye-opening for me personally, thinking about actually the cultural impacts. And also, I expected to be shocked by the environmental impact, some of those stats you threw out about just the Boreal Forest itself, that, you know, just that one ecosystem. What was it, 24.4 million tons of CO2? Did you say 200 times the amount of carbon stored in fossil fuels? Crazy numbers, I expect. Is that right?
Twice.
Twice
the amount of carbon stored in all the remaining oil reserves on the planet.
Which is amazing. But what I didn't expect also was to kind of look at, to understand the cultural impact and actually the trauma it causes to communities that are relying on these trees. Thank you for kind of showing me that perspective. Did not expect it.
You know, just to offer one, a response to the argument that we will often hear from the logging industry, and that is, well, we replant trees. Replantations have nowhere near the same biodiversity value that old growth forests have. Nowhere near the biodiversity value. They have nowhere near the same sustainability ability, like just the ability to sustain themselves. They're much more resilient to wildfires. All over Eastern Canada right now, we have wildfires at a time of year that we've never had them before. They are much more resilient to insect infestation. So yes, fires are part of the boreal regime, but they are happening in much more frequently. And their scope, their range, their size, their depth is much, much deeper than they've ever been before because of climate change, because these parts of the world are warming much, much more quickly than, you know, the equatorial area of the planet. And because we were replacing these high value, biodiversity value ecosystems with tree plantations. Tree plantations that are very highly susceptible to insect infestation and wildfire.
That's a great point. I know that's something we recently recorded an episode on carbon credits, and a lot of carbon crediting is around kind of management of forests and planting of trees. And that's something that I remember coming up was around, you know, what you plant is important. It's not all trees are created equal. So that's a great point to bring up. And I just want to kind of finish by saying that I really love this messaging of community and how we need to be treating our world really as more of a community, because that's how we're going to solve things like climate change. That's how we're going to solve other global problems. So that I found that very moving. So I just wanted to throw that out there.
And I don't know if this is something that interests you, but if I may, you know, I was just in New York City for the United Nations Indigenous Forum. I had the great privilege to be a delegate. It really was an amazing experience sharing space with Indigenous peoples from all over the world, literally from every corner of the globe. And I heard a woman from Kenya, an Indigenous woman, speak about this whole idea of carbon credits and, you know, how large corporations are making a pledge to be carbon neutral by 2045 or 2050. But none of them, obviously, you know, fossil fuel companies, logging companies, mining companies, large extractive industrial companies are not going to change their practices. They are going to emit countless numbers of tons of carbon into the atmosphere just through their practices. But they will claim carbon neutrality by going around the world making agreements for carbon credits. Well, I learned something from this woman from Kenya when she spoke. What companies like Apple, even Apple, that has a large carbon footprint, but maybe not the same as an extractive industrial company does, like ExxonMobil, is when they claim carbon neutrality, in order to purchase these carbon credits, Indigenous peoples are being evicted from their land in order for the land to be determined to be a suitable or credible carbon credit. I couldn't believe this, because what I learned is these forms of conservation are actually a new form of colonization. That's the way Indigenous people around the world are experiencing this whole idea of carbon credits. Shocking.
Yeah. That is so bad. I had no idea.
Yeah, that's horrible. I mean, it makes sense when you say it that that's kind of the approach people have taken, but it's very sad.
When we talk about Indigenous protected and conserved areas in Canada, well, the Indigenous people that I'm in touch with, that I'm friends with, they love this idea. Canada is ceding back. It is a version of land back, is ceding back more and more territory to Indigenous communities to protect and conserve them, as long as they agree to have no extractive industrial activity on it. But in Indigenous communities around the world, like in this place in Kenya, these lands where Indigenous people still live and thrive and depend on the ecosystem for that survival, they still live that way in harmony with the land. In order for those lands to be determined to be carbon creditable, they are being evicted from those lands.
Yeah, I guess it's all very region specific, right?
Wow. So the most vulnerable get screwed, basically.
Yeah. So again, I don't know if that's relevant to our conversation here, but I did want to throw that out because I found it shocking when I learned that a few weeks ago.
No, thank that's you for sharing that. Yeah. Okay. On that sad note, we'll go into something that I think will be more positive. So we're going to wrap up with our green score. So these are two questions that we rank according to a color scheme. So going from black is the worst, brown, gray is middle, forest green, and then lime green is the best.
Ooh,
and
our first, nervous.
The pressure's on here. If you pick the wrong color, you know, you're getting kicked off. Okay, so our first question is always, how easy is it for us as individuals to make a sustainable choice about this product, in this case, toilet paper? And I'll kick us off. I'm actually going to go quite positive here. I'm going to say lime green, which is our top one, because you already mentioned several more sustainable options. You know, there's the recycled paper, like a third of the greenhouse gas emissions of virgin paper. There's the bamboo, again, lower carbon footprint. There's the bidet. There's reusable toilet paper. So, and you can look for that FSC certification. So there is something you can look for. There are specific types of products available for people. So I'm going to go lime green. Michael, what do you think?
I don't know if there's a fluorescent green option, but I'm going past lime green.
Excellent.
When it comes to toilet paper, there are so many options available to us. I will concede that in more remote areas, the large toilet paper companies like Procter & Gamble and Kimberly-Clark, they have a monopoly in those areas. But in large urban centers, we have choices. And you just outlined those choices beautifully. So there is no reason for people to be using tree fiber toilet paper anymore.
Yeah, I could not agree with both of you more. I think we've done so many episodes now where it's not that clear how to make the more sustainable choice. You know, companies or circumstances or the complexity of the product or the problem make it a lot more difficult. But this has been a great one because Michael, as you said, Taylor summed it up perfectly. There's just very, very simple steps we can take to buy more sustainable toilet roll. So yeah, I'm with you guys. Super positive on this one.
Okay, so that brings us to our second and our final green score, and that is how much of a wider impact can making a sustainable choice about toilet paper have? And, I'm feeling a little bit torn here. I think I'm going to go for forest green here, which is kind of the second from the top, just because, yeah, choosing these alternatives, the recycled or the bamboo or no toilet paper whatsoever, that's going to reduce the amount of forest that is being logged, and that's going to have a major reduction of greenhouse gas emissions. I'm not going lime green just because I feel like toilet paper is just one piece of kind of the logging puzzle. There's a lot of other paper products out there that you'd also need to consider reducing or changing your consumption of. But that's what I'm going to go with for now. What do you think, Michael?
Well, given the relatively small piece that toilet paper has in the logging industry, the pulp and paper industry, I'm going to agree with you, forest green, in terms of its potential impact and changing to recycled post-consumer or bamboo or bidet or reusable wipes. given its relatively small percentage of what's being sourced from our forests, I think it can only deserve a forest green rating. But I will say this, once we make a change in one area of our life, it tends to inspire us to look at ways to change other areas of our life. And so I believe in that snowball effect. And if I may, I want to tell one really quick story. At the end of my 42-day journey across the boreal, I had to drop back down into the U.S. for 5 days to interview a couple of people. But my flight home was out of Montreal and the rental car was out of Canada. So I had to drive back into Canada to the airport in Montreal in order to fly home. So as I was crossing back into Canada, I went to this border crossing. Again, I grew up in Montreal, so I've crossed the border in Eastern Canada several times, but I had never been to this border crossing that my navigation system drew me to. And it was a small kiosk, one border guard there, a sort of electronic arm that goes up and down, letting cars in and out. And the woman comes out. She asked me what I'm doing. Again, this is the early days of COVID, so there's not a lot of cross-border traffic happening. I tell her the whole story about my journey across the boreal, about the indigenous peoples I met, the toilet paper aspect of the story, the whole story. She says, well, you're going to have to quarantine again. You're going back into Canada. If you leave Canada like 100 steps, you've left Canada. You have to quarantine again for 14 days. I said to her, I can't quarantine. I've got a flight. I've got to fly home. Please, please, please. She said, well, I'm going to have to call my quarantine officer and ask her what I have to do. So she goes back into her kiosk. I see her typing away on her keyboard. 10 minutes later, she comes back out. She leans her head into my window and she says, I'm not going to call my quarantine officer because I'm concerned she's going to tell me that you have to quarantine. So if you promise me that you're going to drive straight to the airport, drop off the rental car, walk into the terminal, masked, and get onto your plane and fly home, I promise you I will never use Charmin toilet paper again.
I love that.
So I say forest green with a caveat, because one change can inspire another change, and it can inspire other people to change. So we never know what impact a small change can make.
Michael, I think one of the best things you said was about making a small change can lead to other changes. That's exactly the reason that we do this podcast, right, Taylor?
Yeah, I was thinking the exact same thing as you were speaking and telling that story. It's about the snowball effect. You know, that one product might feel like it's just a drop in the bucket. Are you really making that much of a change? But one product turns into multiple products. It turns into you telling your community and them changing. So I really do believe there's a lot of power in making these small changes one at a time until they keep building into something bigger.
And I believe in meeting people where they are. So for instance, if somebody eats meat 7 days a week, if you can persuade them to change their diet to eat 6 days a week, mm-hmm. that's approximately 15% change. So those small changes made by everybody mount up.
Yeah, absolutely. It's never all or nothing, right? And that's a narrative that we're trying to fight against a little bit when it comes to sustainability and environmentalism. It's not that you have to be this perfect eco-warrior. You can just do what you can as when you can do it. And that's a start.
Yeah, could not agree more. And just on my green score, just get it in there before we finish. I'm actually going to go lime green. I think I'm going to go super positive. First of all, this episode is purely about toilet paper, right? If we talked about paper towels or everything else, yes, fine. But this is about toilet paper. So this is a clear choice. You can make a more sustainable choice and it will make a difference. I also think as well, Michael, you've given us a really fantastic insight into the impact it has, not just on planet, but also on the communities that rely on it. And as you said, companies aren't going to change unless, in my view, our consumers make them change, because, you know, companies will follow the money, understandably. This is, you know, capitalism, right? So if people make a change, I think companies will be more likely to follow. And I think a good example is Who Gives a Crap is everywhere at the moment. Their adverts are everywhere. I go to my local coffee shop. They all use them. The restaurants, like everywhere around where I live, uses Who Gives a Crap pretty much. So that is the, you know, if bigger companies, more established companies see that, I think that they're more likely to change. So yeah, for me, this lime green, I don't think we've ever had two lime greens. So super positive on this one.
Okay.
Well, thank you for doing this. I'm so grateful for this work you're doing. This is wonderful. And I really appreciate the opportunity to share this story with your listeners. Thank you so much.
Yeah. Thank you so much for joining us today, Michael. This was an amazing story, and I'm sure our listeners are going to get a lot out of it because I sure did. So to all of our listeners out there, I hope you enjoyed this episode. Thanks, Michael, again for joining us. And as always, please do reach out to us if you want to know more about today's episode or if you want to know about other episodes, you have other ideas. We love to hear from our listeners and are always too keen to hear your ideas. So thanks once again for joining us, and we'll see you on the next episode.